My name is Shay Smith. I'm the director of HALO in Nevada City, Health Alternatives for All Locals. We are a local nonprofit set up to provide alternatives to people's health conditions. I would like to welcome Julie McIntyre. I had the pleasure of spending some time with her when she first arrived here from Silver City, New Mexico. And this is quite an amazing woman. This is a woman who is healing from a heart full of compassion, of seeing the effects of Lyme, and wanting to help humanity. She works with people from all over the world. Her consultations are usually done by phone and over Skype. Most of her patients she never meets in person. And she is just an amazing gift to have come to our community and share her knowledge of herbs and plant medicine and treatment for Lyme. So, Julie, thank you so very much, and welcome.
Hi, welcome, good morning. Thank you all for being here, for extending your energy and time and resources to be here. It's really greatly appreciated. I want to thank again Shay and all the folks at HALO, Rachel, Barry really started this rolling to get us here. And I know that for some of you it took a great deal of effort, even epic proportions, to get here. Just tremendously humbling, actually. So I want to thank a number of people, all of my clients, for one thing, for the last decade, for being one of my greatest teachers, and they continue to be. I want to thank the plants and their medicines. And in no small way, Stephen Aaron Buhner has really taken herbal medicine to sophisticated levels for healing these diseases. As we find ourselves continually in a world of difficult to treat diseases of epidemic proportions. So the talk today is possible because of Stephen's work and the protocols set out in his book, Healing Lyme and Co-Infections. And I'll go over that in the beginning, but primarily I want to spend a lot of time on the new book that will be coming out next spring on Mycoplasma and Bartonella. They were touched on a little bit in Healing Lyme, but they're becoming, in my opinion, in my experience, Mycoplasma, one of the most difficult, misunderstood, misdiagnosed, misglossed over infection that's causing a lot of difficulties and may explain why there's recurrent infections and relapses. So I am going to spend a great deal of time on that, the background of it and the protocol and the herbs to address that specifically. So there's a lot of new work here that's tiny bits of it are Stephen's putting on the Healing Buhner Lyme website. Some of the Bartonella and Mycoplasma is there. So, but I want to, you know, really give you a lot of new information today. So I want to send a heartfelt thank you to him, to Stephen, for the plants, for all of you, for, you know, and his encouragement and support in this work. As you all know, it gets really tremendously heartbreaking, difficult sometimes. So we'll look in depth at the herbs and supplements used to reduce inflammation, pain, to rebuild cartilage and collagen, protect and rebuild red blood cells, protect and heal the brain and central nervous system, and address issues of the GI tract. A number of things I'm covering, as I said, well, is coming out of new research. And this field of infections is massive. There's no way I can give you everything that we have. For one thing, it's changing, it's dynamic. There's more research, new stuff coming up all the time. But this is a really good starting point. It's a good foundation. And my clients have been As you know, those of you who are friends or you have Lyme disease or infections, you're some of the best researchers on the planet. You have your pulse directly on what's going on and symptoms and new research. So I have tremendous respect, and I always listen to my clients when they tell me new stuff and follow those threads. So, and any practitioners working with this, this is a really crucial thing to keep in mind, that your clients, they know what's going on. They live inside their bodies, and they're doing research all of the time, and they're one of your greatest teachers. And no one has all the answers. There's new and deeper understanding of the bacteria and co-infections and how they work inside the body, emerging all the time. And what I've seen is how Lyme disease and co-infections and treating them are community diseases. And this is an example of how these diseases create community. All of the Lyme support groups that have sprung up on the internet and small communities centralizing around these diseases, in no small way does the healing come out of these communities. And people with these infections need the support. They need to know they're companioned on their way, because it's a lonely disease, and it's terrifying. And one of the best things, one of the most healing things they need is at least someone who cares, who answers their phone calls, who answers emails. So following through is keeping the compassion going and support. And that may be the defining element of success, along with compassion and humility, is to know this thing and to companion them along the way. For their suffering is a constant source and reminder of my own humiliation and limitations as a human being and a clinician. Through their great need and tremendous suffering, my clients teach me the fragility of having a human envelope and at times the seemingly unbearable suffering we all endure. And I want to take a moment of silence to remember and honor those who have suffered, who have lost their lives, lost their families, their homes. We all know someone intimately. And I want to thank the communities that have begun to grow in response to these illnesses. And I thank you all for these most greatest gifts, for the humility, for the teachings, for your courage, for your compassion. And having a chronic and lingering illness, as you know, affords you a number of significant changes in personality. A number of times I'll get clients, and first-time clients, and they'll say, I just want to have my life back. And I have to tell them, you will have a life, but it won't be the old one. The life you had before is transforming, and it will be new on the other side of it. That's one of the functions of illness. People with Lyme disease and co-infections are some of the best, or I said that research is on the planet, I'm getting ahead of myself. So the illness also affords a great opportunity to understand our anatomy. A number of times before we get ill, we had very little sense of what our immune system is and all of the parts of our immune system. We get more knowledge about our adrenals and our kidneys and our thyroid and how sleep patterns and our emotions affect our immune system. So it's a great teacher of our anatomy and our bodies, these beautiful, magnificent, our own pieces of Mother Earth that we call our human body. More and more I see the tremendous and crucial role of and need for love and deep caring and compassion that can often be the turning point for someone who is sick. For some, it's the first time they've received love and caring. So this talk is on Lyme and co-infections. And I've oriented it this way because the first diseases people learned about was Lyme disease. I mean, it really could be called, instead of Lyme and co-infections, it could be mycoplasma, it could be called Bartonella, but it just happened to be the first one that was identified and named. And rather than Lyme and co-infections, it might be more accurate to say Lyme and Lyme continuum infections to be more inclusive about it. Or even more accurately, to describe them as arthropod-transmitted emerging diseases. For arthropods, those are invertebrate animals with exoskeletons. They're segmented bodies and jointed appendages. They, in fact, form a complex of emerging diseases that are moving into the human population in increasing frequency. And I want to take a moment to say some of this is going to be disturbing. It's going to be a little scary and unsettling when you get into this and see the impact of it. But there is hope. There truly is hope. So here's what we found about Lyme since Healing Lyme came out in 2005. And there will be an update in a couple years with a lot more of this information in it. The core protocol still works, and which is Japanese knotweed, cat's claw, andrographis, Eleutherococcus, and we go from there and expand on there. Those are still the core protocol. So how I want to do this is talk through Lyme infection and some of the symptoms and herbs for that. And then, depending on our time, maybe answer some questions at that point and then go into mycoplasma. And I'm going to spend a great deal on mycoplasma. Take another break, maybe lunchtime by then, answer questions, and then go into Bartonella, Ehrlichia, Babesia. So I want to give you enough technical information in as much as it's necessary to understand the diseases, but primarily I've stripped the information down to bite-sized, user-friendly information to help you get some footing in reducing the infections and increasing immune function. Some of this, as we get into it, as I said, was going to be the equivalent of reading a futuristic sci-fi novel, but they often have good endings. So hope I can leave you on a good note. So to give you a little background information on these emerging infections and ecosystem disruptions, the reason for starting with this is because our old way of viewing bacteria and treating them is no longer working very well. In fact, it's actually often causing more damage than good. Without a comprehensive or at least at the very least, a beginning understanding of what these infections are, how they got this way, and why using the old medical paradigm of antibiotics kill the invader philosophy in most cases is not good enough and not effective long enough. There are times when antibiotics are important and supportive. Bacteria and viruses adapt and become more virulent through genetic rearrangement. Learned resistance to antivirals and antibiotics, and most of all because of changes in the world in which all of us live. Those changes are profound. And here are some of the major alterations affecting the planet that researchers have identified as being behind the emergence of so many old and new diseases. Human populations and refugee increases, accelerated mobility, worldwide urbanization, increasing population density in confined spaces such as inner cities and prisons. Medical-related infections in hospitals, concentrated microbial intermingling in hospitals and nursing homes, blood transfusions, organ transplants, reused medical equipment, pharmaceutical contaminants, viral and antibiotic resistance. Overly extensive industrial agriculture with the resultant damage of ecosystem homeodynamics. Worldwide disbursement of commercial food animals, food plants, agricultural pharmaceuticals. Deforestation, waterway disturbances, reduction in predator populations, destruction of wild plant populations, and in a minute you'll see why this is significantly impacting the spread of these diseases. Disruption in climate homeodynamics and anthropogenic forces, factors such as global warming, CO2 increases in pollutant gases. All these things paint a grim picture for humanity and simultaneously offer resistant and intelligent bacteria and viruses terrain ripe for proliferation and evolution. These particular disease complexes are very unique when compared to the older diseases that we've been dealing with since the early 1900s. In a way of thinking, we've actually killed off all the easy diseases. So the older model of using antibiotics to kill the invading organism is no longer very functional. As a matter of fact, that model is beginning to fail with increasing frequency. Despite the announcement in the mid to late 20th century when the first antibiotic, penicillin, came into common use that it was the end of infectious disease for all time, the fact today is that Infectious disease is becoming more of a problem in the industrialized world every year, and resistant bacteria are making massive inroads in hospitals. One of the more common sentences in newspaper obituaries today is, died of complications following surgery, right? You've all seen that? They rarely say that in nearly all cases, those complications are resistant bacteria the patient picked up in the hospital. In fact, a client told me of the tremendous stress she'd been under in the last year. Part of that was a dear friend of hers who died in the hospital from a routine knee replacement surgery. There are two factors that have stimulated the emergence of potent bacterial disease organisms. The first is the tremendous overuse of antibiotics over the past 70 years. The second is the extreme ecological disruption that increasing human population density is causing. In a very short period of geologic time, the Earth has been saturated with hundreds of tons of non-biodegradable, often biologically unique pharmaceuticals designed to kill bacteria. Many antibiotics do not discriminate in their activity, but kill broad groups of diverse bacteria whenever they are used. How's everybody feeling? Ecological disruption has also played an extensive role in increasing damage to wild landscapes. Intrusions to plant diversity and its crucial homeodynamic functions by suburb and agricultural intrusions, the reduction of wild predators, the increase in deer, mice, and insect populations as a result have also put tremendous pressure on bacterial populations. As fewer and fewer wild animal populations are available as hosts for the bacterial diseases that once were mostly limited to those populations, the bacteria have no choice. In order to survive, they have to jump species. That is, they find new hosts, being us. Because human beings now live in the habitat formerly occupied by those animals, many of the bacteria are now learning to live in human beings. Unfortunately, both bacterial resistance and ecological disruption can't help but intersect with terrible ramifications. Many of the primary co-infections of Lyme are closely related to some of the most potent resistant bacterial organisms known. And they're all members of the Proteobacteria phylum. It's a large and genomically close group of bacteria. One of the branches of the proteobacteria includes Bartonella, another includes Ehrlichia, Anaplasma, Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, and Rickettsia, all of which are co-infections of Lyme. There is strong evidence that both resistance and virulence factors are being shared among all members of this phylum. In other words, the various bacteria are teaching each other how to resist antibiotics and how to more easily infect humans, thus making us sicker. They do this usually through sharing segments of DNA they have within them, resistance and virulence information. Bartonella organisms are often co-infective with many of the bacteria in the phylum, and in many instances, these kinds of multiple infections shows a remarkable synergy during the disease process. In other words, the bacteria work together to reduce the effectiveness of the immune response and thus enable long-term infection. In practical terms, what this means is that a great many more diseases are emerging out of the ecological matrix of the planet and infecting human beings. And many of them possess or soon acquire resistance to many of the most of the antibiotics that people use to treat bacterial diseases. And what they do together in the body is a great deal more complex than what any one of them alone does. And this makes them very difficult to treat and very difficult to suss out and pinpoint who's doing what in the body. It has become also clear that many new infections and others simply not recognized as being infections, for example, endocarditis from Bartonella infection, that is inflammation of the inner lining of the heart, or arthritis from Lyme bacteria, are emerging with greater frequency and virulence in the human population. Co-infections with Lyme disease is one major grouping of these types of infections. The list includes, but is not limited to, those infections caused by Babesia, Bartonella, Ehrlichia, Anaplasma, Mycoplasma, Coxiella, and Rickettsia organisms. And those clinicians who specialize in treating Lyme disease have long been aware of the complex problems attendant with treating someone with multiple co-infections. Though awareness of co-infections is slowly becoming part of the daily life of researchers, and as a result, some very good information is coming to the fore. Information is emerging on the synergy between co-infections agents during active infections, ultimately making the territory a little more understandable to navigate. So some of the key factors that need to be taken into consideration when treating co-infections is that co-infected bacteria interact both in the vector, that's the insect or, you know, the one carrying it, that spreads them, and then in the host they are transferred to, and those interactions have a great impact on patient outcomes. One of the first things to understand is that co-infectious organisms have tremendous genetic flexibility. These bacteria have been around since Gaia took her first breath, and they are incredibly intelligent, adaptable, and they're able to shift their genetic sequence in response to multiple environmental factors. These bacteria have been around, co-infectious bacteria that congregate inside ticks or other arthropod vectors exchange information with each other, including how to alter DNA to avoid antibiotics and host immune responses. It should be assumed whenever a chronic case of Lyme or Lyme co-infections is encountered that multiple genetic variants exist and are being regularly generated within the infected person. This is becoming the norm rather than the exception. Treatment has to become more sophisticated in order to be successful, and looking at cytokine cascades is one way to get a more sophisticated approach. One of the most important understandings now facing us is accepting the limits of pharmaceuticals in the treatment of many of these diseases. While antibiotics do still have a role, sometimes a very important one, they can no longer be relied upon completely to provide the sole response to these kinds of diseases. And we have to really think outside the boxes. We have to approach treatment with more sophisticated eye. And there are two important aspects to this. The first is realizing that single treatment approaches based on identifying the bacterial pathogen and killing it are going to have to be abandoned as a primary method of treating these kinds of diseases. The second is coming to understand just what the bacteria do in the body, and then designing a treatment protocol that is specific in counteracting what the organisms do, if you can exactly. And it takes building your skill base and being attentive and relentless. In essence, this means designing treatment protocols that address bacterial cytokine cascades, which I'll get into in a moment because that's a very important part of the understanding these symptoms and the infections, and reducing symptom pictures. The particular health or non-health of the person's immune system and specific symptom picture that is reducing the quality of the person's life. Combined with antibacterials of whatever sort, this creates the most sophisticated basic approach to the treatment of bacterial diseases. If you add to that sophisticated human-to-human interaction oriented around deep caring and personal presence, you have at the core the most elegant and potent paradigm of healing disease that can occur. Some additional sophistications can occur. Among them are the synergy that occurs among the healing agents that are used and those that exist between the different bacteria. That is, we must learn to look at what happens when there are multiple infectious bacteria all coming into the body from, say, a tick bite. An example of this is what AIDS and cancer have taught us. AIDS, along with cancer, because of its spread, is its disease dynamics and its amazing adaptability has forced a shift from a monotherapy frame treatment to that of a multi-target paradigm of therapeutics. Multi-target therapeutics not only focus on killing the disease organism with which AIDS and cancers are often futile, but also focus deeply on activating the natural defense, protective and repair mechanisms of the body. In other words, they also stimulate immune responses to disease and as well the body's own highly elegant repair mechanisms. AIDS has changed medicine and our way of thinking about disease and the medical paradigm in a number of significant ways. Perhaps a major one is that it has significantly increased the understanding of the importance of the immune system and its relation to disease onset. As with Bartonella and Lyme, mycoplasma infections have been found to be highly responsive to the health of the individual's immune system. In other words, if immune health is high, then the mycoplasma organisms will either be prevented from causing infection entirely, or else the disease itself will be very mild. The more depleted the immune system, the worse the disease that develops. As researcher Mark Lapp has commented, it is the body which ultimately controls infections, not the chemicals. Without underlying immunity, drugs are meaningless. Many of these disease-causing mycoplasmas were only discovered because the diseases they caused were so virulent in those with AIDS. The physicians knew something was causing problems, even if they couldn't find it. And AIDS taught physicians that no matter what they did, no matter what drug they used, if the body itself could not mount an immune response, then the disease could not be either controlled or eradicated. When treating Lyme and co-infections, working with immune health is paramount. Basically, now rather than kill the invader approach, we have to look at dealing with these diseases in a very different way, and that is really the most important things to do now are reduce cytokine cascade, enhance the immune function that is depressed, and address symptom picture to increase quality of life. And that's what we'll be talking about when we're addressing these infections, and then adding antimicrobials as needed. In the last 30 years, we've all these diseases emerging, and the old system does not work so well any longer. These infections have sophisticated complexes for surviving, and they have been adapting to assaults and threats to their life for 3 billion years. They've had a lot of experience. Our immune function is the result of billions of years of evolution, and it is supremely qualified to deal with infections if it is supported. And plants have sophisticated structures to deal with infections. So co-infection bacteria interact both in the vector that spreads them, for example, a flea or tick, and then in the host they are transferred to. One of the better articles on this is Andrea Graham and others, and she said, transmission consequences of co-infections, cytokines writ large that appeared in trends in parasitology. In 2007, the authors proposed a unique approach to understanding the dynamics of co-infections. Instead of focusing on the bacteria, the organisms themselves, they suggest focusing on the cytokine cascades that the organisms produce in the body. They comment that when the taxonomic identities of parasites are replaced with their cytokine signatures, for example, it becomes possible to predict the within-host consequences of co-infection for microparasitic replication, as well as symptom picture, treatment approaches, and treatment outcomes. There's been a lot of research on the role of cytokines, and reducing cytokines equals reducing symptoms and bacterial load. Cytokines are small cell signaling molecules released by the immune system and the glial cells of the nervous system that are important in intercellular communications in the body. So a brief talk about cytokines a little bit so you can start to kind of wrap your mind around how this works. Cytokines are messenger molecules. So a bacteria enters the body and it finds its way to its preferred habitat with specific mechanisms for getting there. Once they have arrived, they go into the cells in the locations they like the most, just like we all have our favorite restaurants. Bacteria like have their favorite places in your body that support their health and livelihood. Then they release at the cellular level a messenger molecule called the cytokine, which then essentially makes the cell behave in ways that is beneficial to the bacteria. At the same time, it will stimulate the host immune response to it also generating messenger molecules, which causes the cell to lose its surface integrity, making the cell membrane permeable and penetrable so the bacteria can go in deeper. Either the bacteria go inside the cell where they're able to hide from the immune system and can feed on the cellular components and have a reproductive orgy, or it causes the cell to break apart, lysis, into components which are scavenged by the bacteria. Each bacteria uses different kinds of cytokines depending on what they need and what they need the cell to do. So addressing cytokine cascade effectively shuts down its symptoms, reduces bacterial load, addresses immune function. The most elegance occurs if you find an herb or herbal combination that addresses all of those categories. And then adding antimicrobials to kill bacteria and viruses. This is not a simple disease or simple disease picture. They are stealth pathogens with tremendous genome flexibility and intelligence. Antibiotics are supportive. And if you don't know the cause but have an understanding of symptoms and pathogen mechanisms, that is, how the bacteria act and their pathways in the body, you can design a protocol that is flexible and works. So paying keen attention to shifts and changes in how the patient is responding, paying keen attention to how you feel as a practitioner, how your client feels, and makes adjustments accordingly. For example, with anemia, you know the red blood cells are involved. So you add hawthorn or Cedar acuta and L-arginine to protect and make new red blood cells. For brain fog, there's inflammation affecting the neural structures, so you use knotweed, Japanese knotweed, phosphatidylserine, EGCG, which is a green tea extract. And there's many more, but that gives you an idea if you know what's going on and you have herbs and supplements to address those specific symptoms. In practical terms, when a bacteria touches a cell, the cell gives off a signal, a cytokine, that tells the immune system what is happening and what that cell needs. Each type of infectious bacteria initiates a particular kind of cytokine cascade. And in Stephen's books, in Lyme and in the Mycoplasma, he lays out all of the cytokines involved. If that information is exciting to you, it makes me a little crazy to look at numbers and abbreviated letters, but understanding cytokines even generally will give you tremendous foothold in addressing disease. So each type of infectious bacteria initiates a particular kind of cytokine cascades, which is an initial and very powerful cytokine, is released into the body. That initial cytokine stimulates the production of others and those still others, all of which have potent impacts on the body. It is these, in fact, that create most of the symptoms that people experience when you're ill. Understanding what these co-infections do when someone is infected, understanding their cytokine cascade, determines many of the most effective approaches to treat the conditions they cause. And I'll get into that specifically in a bit. Bacteria have learned to work synergistically together, or for instance, take advantage of the biological active components in tick saliva in order to facilitate avoidance of the immune system. Tick saliva itself begins a cytokine cascade, which Lyme bacteria take advantage of in order to more effectively infect a new host. Bartonella, like many infectious bacteria, utilize the immune system of whatever mammal they infect as part of their infection strategy. They essentially use our own body's response to them to promote their agenda. What this means is that the bacteria use the inflammatory processes already occurring in the body. So, for example, if you have pre-existing arthritis, the bacteria will use that weakened system to facilitate successful infection. So while the immune system is often compromised by the cytokine dynamics initiated by one type of bacteria, multiple simultaneously initiated cascades are more potent in their impacts. Infection is much more easily accomplished. Additionally, assaults on multiple body systems occur. If Bartonella is a co-infection with Lyme, what you get then is assault on and resultant degradation of the collagen system by the Lyme bacteria in the body, and a simultaneous assault on red blood cells, along with continual subversion and abnormalization of endothelial cells and their functions by Bartonella. Since Lyme spirochetes damage collagen tissues, for instance, in the joints of the knee, the body will send CD34 cells to that site to help repair the damage, but some of those cells will be infected with Bartonella, which has a tendency to infect those precursor cells in the bone marrow. Bartonella will take advantage of the local inflammation to establish a colony in that location that itself will contribute to collagen degradation the Lyme spirochetes are causing. If the person were to already be suffering with a pre-existing inflammation in the joint location, the process is even easier for the bacteria. If you add other co-infectious bacteria to the mix, the picture is even more complicated. For example, if Babesia are present, then the red blood cells are going to have two organisms infecting them, Bartonella and Babesia, thus increasing the deleterious impacts on the red blood cells. As Graham and others commented as they were researching, hosts that are co-infected by multiple parasite species seem to be the rule rather than the exception in natural systems, and some of the most devastating human diseases are associated with co-infections that challenge immune response efficacy. Attention to the immune system is essential when dealing with these co-infections. The reduced ability of the host immune response to control bacterial infection apparently results in a bacterium of longer duration. People with intact immune function who become infected with Bartonella henselae, for example, usually don't even experience severe symptoms if their immune system is functioning. The immune status of someone with co-infections must be addressed as any part of the treatment protocol. Because co-infections are synergistic in nature, there is an inescapable truth, which is the weaker or more compromised the immune system, the more likely someone is to become infected, and the more likely they are to have a debilitating course of illness. Improving the immune system status of those with chronic Bartonellosis, for instance, allows the immune system to do what it does best. And that is to use very elegant mechanisms to control and clear infection. Eventually, the healthy immune system begins to identify the outer membrane proteins of the bacteria and creates antibodies to them. Due to the sophistication of the bacteria's subversion of the host immune system, this often takes anywhere from 4 to 8 months with Bartonella infections. And what I've been finding is the duration can be shorter. It really depends on your immune system. I've seen elderly people with pretty strong immune systems recover from severe infection, you know, in 6 months. I've seen teenagers, young adults that were nearly bedridden start to, almost as if they're coming out of a coma, start to be more interactive within 3 months. They still have a long way to go, but they're showing significant movement in the right direction of their immune system responding and the cytokines and infections decreasing. In those whose immune systems are compromised, it may take longer. How long is directly proportional to the health of the immune system. Once immune system creates the proper antigens, the bacteria are then eliminated fairly rapidly from the body. Reinfection is difficult as the antibodies remain in the body for some time. Difficult, but not impossible. The synergy of the co-infections' impacts on immune function has to be addressed as well. As Graham and others commented, attempts by the immune system to simultaneously counter the multiple parasite species involved in a co-infection can lead to immunopathological disease and pathology that are more than simple additive pathogenic effects. For example, infection with both Bartonella and Babesia are synergistically impactful on red blood cells and can reduce red blood cell counts up to 25%. Leading to anemia, fatigue, breathlessness, and general weakness. A positive note is that because both bacteria are competing for red blood cells, longer studies have found that the Babesia over time tends to clear the Bartonella infection by outcompeting them. In the initial stages, however, the impact on red blood cells is immense. Babesia are thought to sequester themselves in the capillary cells of the spleen and liver. Bartonella species sequester themselves in the endothelial cells of the capillary networks of the spleen and liver. Both then seed the bloodstream from those locations at regular intervals. The impacts of infection with both parasites on the spleen and liver are much greater than either alone, and this has to be taken into account in any treatment approach. In other words, you have to design a spleen-liver treatment supportive intervention that are extremely focused on normalizing functions and reducing inflammation in those organs. This protects them from cytokine damage and begins to reduce habitat for the bacteria, thus reducing bacterial load and presence in the body. Other research has found that infection with anaplasma, for example, made subsequent infection by Babesia much more certain. In fact, it made it twice as likely to occur, reversing the order of infection found the same rate of increase. As well, animals infected with one Bartonella species who were also infected by other Bartonella species were much more likely to have long-term infections, a chronic illness. Okay. So I'm just seeing if I need to say or if I skip ahead to some important stuff. Co-infection with Anaplasma, Bartonella, for example, are more severe in disease progression in that both, in both which blood cells and red blood cells are infected. Specifically, Anaplasma and Ehrlichia infect neutrophils, the most abundant form of white blood cells in the body, and an essential part of the innate immune system. Thus, the immune system is fighting not only the bacteria in the red blood cells and vascular tissues, but bacteria inside its own immune system. To make it worse, the bacteria crosstalk and engage in mutual support of each other and actually enhancing each other's impacts on the host and the resistance to antibiotics. During co-infection with both Mycoplasma and Bartonella, which is more and more common, there are going to be severe effects on the endothelial cells, the red blood cells, and the brain and central nervous system that are out of proportion to infection by either organism alone. So the cytokine impacts on those areas of the body are going to be stronger, synergistic, and more debilitating. Treatment regimens must be designed to reverse much stronger effects that would occur by one alone. So this often calls for larger doses, longer treatment duration, and more sophisticated intervention for symptom management, because the symptoms will change, ebb and flow, and minimize and increase over time. As only one example of such a double infection, which may cause both a form of regular epileptic seizures and periodic bouts of homicidal rage. Herbs that reduce the cytokine cascades involved and are specific for these types of seizures and are particularly calming to the nervous system, thus reducing extreme rage events, need to be used, and the doses need to be on the largest side, continuous and very focused. Chinese skullcap, for example, is a specific herb that tends, a specific example that tends to be synergistic with several others, such as motherwort and passiflower, that are also specific for these kinds of conditions, though in slightly different ways. We'll get into those in detail when we get to the materia medica, probably this afternoon. So when approaching the treatment of co-infections, the approach should be depth-based with rigor of analysis. The bacterial infections need to be identified as much as possible, but it is very possible to work without identifying them specifically. Once a diagnosis is achieved, a treatment protocol should be initiated. Those of us concerned with Lyme disease and co-infections have heard stories, and I still hear them several times a month, about physicians, healers, insisting that Lyme could not be the cause of a person's symptoms, simply because they didn't exhibit a rash, or no, Lyme really isn't endemic in our area. It's particularly insidious in Canada. That sort of thinking is, I believe, politically motivated, if I say so. still, in some cases, there's still a refusal to test for Lyme or co-infections, or that the person already had antibiotics for treatment, so of course you can't have Lyme disease anymore. Or even more painfully, the disease is in your head. This information's been out for a decade. We're still hearing these stories. Still, in some cases, antibiotics are very effective, and with diseases as debilitating as Lyme and co-infections, they should be considered, actually. However, if that kind of approach doesn't work, then a depth understanding of the cytokine cascades and likely interactions between co-infections should be undertaken and treatment protocol initiated that addresses this in depth. The most important thing in treating co-infections is to reduce the inflammatory process. The bacteria initiate and reduce the cytokine cascades. That stops the majority of symptoms right there, especially if treatment protocols are initiated that are designed to protect the areas of the body that are affected. An immune response that effectively cleared the infection from endothelial cells, said Teffler, and researchers would therefore ultimately control an infection. This applies as well to any intervention that will protect endothelial tissue from bacteria. So if you use Japanese knotweed or EGCG, and the word for that is really long and I don't want to actually try to pronounce it, but it's the green tea extract, as an interventive, abnormal endothelial cell inflammation ceases. The bacteria can't survive if they're not able to initiate their particular form of inflammation in the body. It's how they make habitat and scavenge for food. Enhancing immune function then allows the body to deal with the infection on its own. The addition of protocols to reduce specific symptoms that are occurring, for example, arthritis, and help restore quality of life are also important. Not only does this support the body's health at that location, but also the person's overall quality of life is enhanced. And once you start to get a little glimmer of hope, once there's a little reduction in symptoms and your hope starts to go, then you've got something to work with. And you can keep going in those directions. Finally, the human response of the healer, once again, and I'm probably noticed I'm quite on fire about this part of it. The human response of the healer toward the patient is essential. People who are ill need deep, caring contact with another human being. As human beings, we have to have a certain number of strokes, physical strokes, emotional strokes, for our health and well-being every day. It's an essential aspect of healing. Physicians, herbalists, and naturopaths who don't take the time for this really maybe should call themselves accountants or something else. or something other than healer, for they're actually engaging in a betrayal of trust from their patients. I've seen this and I teach it to my apprentices and I've read stories and have found that this one thing in and of itself contributes significantly to the successful resolution of illness. Genuine caring is medicine. And it is time, well past time, that we recognize this on a cultural level. I have a client that I care deeply about and love her, and I've been working with her for a while, and I don't know if she'll get well, partly because she has no support system. She has no support system. I'm it, and we're, a phone call away, but sometimes I can't be there, and when we're not talking, she's in limbo on her own. Sometimes she'll call and say, I'm the only person that cares about her, and she's abandoned. And it's such, you have to have the resources to reach out, to return phone calls, to email, even when you're exhausted. And then, the healers will talk about how to take care of yourself. That's important, too, like putting, the oxygen mask on so that you can help others. But being present, extending compassion and care, showing up, keeping your word. It's part of our humanity, our humility, our compassion. I believe we must abandon the paradigm that insists that we not touch our patients. We've become a culture of fear of touch, fear of compassion, that we not love them. Abandon those paradigms that say we can't touch, that we can't love them, that we can't care for them, that we can't show caring, and to not listen to them attentively, that we not act as guides for them on the journey through this maelstrom of debilitating diseases. We all know how this has come about, and we've agreed, become complicit in our race to the courtroom and lawsuits and fear-mongering, but what cruelty has been the cost of our fear of touch? And yes, I have, as you've indicated, we all have strong feelings about this. And outrage has a function, can change existing paradigms. Relying on the kill the invader approach is going to become increasingly ineffective as time goes on. In fact, it's already failing. The bacteria are evolving, and we should evolve in our approach to healing emerging diseases. From Stephen's forthcoming book next fall, I think, Herbal Antivirals. Yeah, good book. Plant-based medicines, unlike pharmaceuticals, don't cause resistance problems. They're much safer, and they are ecologically sound. They are biodegradable and renewable. which most pharmaceuticals are not. Herbal antibiotics are easy to use, easy to grow, easy to make into medicines for yourself, your family, and your patients. And they are very effective for emerging and resistant bacteria and viruses. Plants learned a long time ago how to stop viruses and bacteria from killing them. Plants know, they make bacteria, antibacterials and antivirals. They have to for their own survival. They're their own physicians. They know how to do that in our bodies as well. Our bodies know how to assimilate plant medicines. Our liver knows what to do with them. Our kidneys, our bodies are innately interwoven with plant medicines, and they know how to work together elegantly. Interestingly enough, outside Western industrialized nations, countries such as Africa and Asia, South and Central America have been turning away from pharmaceuticals and utilizing herbal antibiotics and antivirals as primary first defense in the treatment of resistant diseases. Researchers and cultures around the world are finding that plant antibacterials are often more effective than pharmaceuticals. So they are exploring which ones are most potent, which forms of preparations are most effective, and how best to use them. Some of our best research is coming out of those countries. In Africa, once this information is gathered, this is what they do with it. Researchers travel across the continent giving seeds to local village people, teaching them, sorry, this is touching, teaching them what they've learned and letting them go on with their own health care and healing. The researchers are taking the seeds to the villages and teaching them how to make their and grow and make their own medicine. The paradigm of Medicare that emerged in the 20th century that has influenced our thinking and approaches to disease treatment has had detrimental consequences. As many of you are becoming aware, the emergence of epidemics we are facing now is more devastating than any we've known before. Some of the things we know is that cat's claw enhances immune function. Knotweed is root is specific and primary for interrupting cytokine cascades by the Lyme spirochetes, and it's effective in a number of these other co-infections as well. Neurological impacts also have psychological impacts. So if you deal with neuroborrelia or neuro-anything, you've got a concomitant list of psychological symptoms that have to be addressed simultaneously. They give indications of what's happening in what part of the brain. The amygdala will have more serious consequences. That's where homicidal rage is affected, comes out of the amygdala damage and inflammation. The hippocampus affects spatial orientation and balance. Psychosis will appear more as sensory inundation and not understanding the meaning of the world around you. Neural damage begins to interfere with sensory inputs. Sensitivity to sounds, lights, smells. Once neuronal damage is created, more sensory inputs come in that used to be filtered out. So they're essentially sensory gating channels or doors of perception, all this hex they call them, doors of perception. In the infections, normally those doors open and close and they filter things out. But in these infections, they don't close. So you get this oversensitization to sensory input. So since those are sensory gating interferences. The amygdala activates out-of-control emotions that can't be dampened down. Neurological structures and herbs to support psychosis is very important. It's unconscionable for healers to not deal with the psychosis, to focus on the body only. Neural damage takes a long time, and you have to have caring to get people through it. Neural damage takes a long time, and healing neural damage takes a long time. And then there's the physical, all the body symptoms, and the GI tract, arthritis, the heart, liver, detox pathways, and so on must be attended to. So some key points to remember is to think and look outside the box. Often it requires us to give up what we think we know so that we can see what's right in front of us. Recently, I had a new client a couple weeks ago, and her symptom list was showing mycoplasma. It was on my radar, mycoplasma. But she'd only been tested for Lyme that was showing up. And then I looked at her history, and in 2005, she had a blood transfusion. I said, ha. So noticing, knowing what to look for, and then just noticing what's there and asking questions, you know, calibrating what you're seeing. Okay, and trusting the plants and their medicines. Trusting the plants and their medicines and trusting your bodies. The protocol I'll be giving you this afternoon, protocols I'll be giving you, they're guidelines. And it's important for you as practitioners and people taking them to pay attention to your body. You live inside there. You're your best physician because you're intimate. You know what's going on. You know how the medicines feel. You know what they're doing inside. You know your symptom picture. So the plants have a tremendous flexibility, and one of my philosophies, it's better to have low doses, if that's what you can tolerate, than none at all, and build up as your body adjusts. Some clients, depending if they offer an opening, that they'd be open to this, I have them set up altars in their home for their medicines. Been in a lot of research that if you pray with things, it activates and potentiates medicines. Okay, so how are we doing with our break?
5 minutes.
Okay. Let's see. Well, this would be a good 5-minute period for. Are there any questions written yet? Yeah.
One of the things that's been brought to my attention by a lot of local naturopaths is increase of radiation poisoning from Fukushima. And increase things like radioactive cesium showing up as well during heavy metal testing. You explain that as well? That's where we are.
It depends on where you are, but the concentration depends on where you are. Actually, there's radiation in the air, air samples in all of the lower 48 states. It shows up in air samples in every state. It's just more concentrated along the coast. Yep.
My aunt has lupus, and after she was diagnosed with that, she got bit by a Lyme tick, took the antibiotics and was quote-unquote fine, but I keep waiting to hear from her. And so what kind of advice would you give to somebody who already has a serious condition? She's doing so-so. She got bit by Lyme, did really badly, recovered, but they didn't test for co-infection.
I would test for mycoplasma immediately. There's been some evidence being released recently that it's involved in autoimmune diseases, lupus. I would check for mycoplasma. Mycoplasma, you know, I'll tell you, it's on my radar. It's high, hugely on my radar. You'll find out later why.
And that can be detected.
Special blood test. And I should have, and I'm sorry I don't have this information. One of my clients got it tested in a stool sample that showed up. Yeah.
Is Bartonella also prey on
fleas? Fleas, ticks, mites, biting flies, spiders. That's why I mentioned arthropod diseases.
Oh, okay.
So think arthropod. And that's another way, example of thinking outside the box. I mean, there's still people go, oh, I didn't get bit by, you know, I've got this arthritis, but I didn't get a tick, or I didn't have a rash. But it's not just ticks. In fact, I just saw on the CDC's website, infuriated me, they're still saying, even if it's old, it's still on their website, that only black-legged ticks transmit diseases.
And what about mosquitoes?
Oh, yes. You know, particularly, you know, encephalitis. Okay, one more.
Is Lyme and any of the co-infections, can they be sexually transmitted?
Can you repeat the question, please?
Can Lyme and any of the co-infections be sexually transmitted? Sorry, that was my job description. I dropped it. Thanks.
You're fired.
Oh, yeah, I know. Next. There, spirochetes have shown up in placenta. We don't know for certain that it's sexually transmitted. Mycoplasma, definitely. It's there's a species of mycoplasma, mycoplasma spermatosum something, is transmitted through semen, through sperm, and transmitted to the vagina and the reproductive system, and it can go the other way and swim up the penis into the male's reproductive system. Break or another one?
One more.
Okay. Yeah.
A question about breast milk and Lyme passing through breast milk. Is there any, what do you know about studies in breast milk and whether it's been found to be transmuted through breast milk or any other co-infection?
I don't know about the infections, and I can't speak to that intelligently at this moment. I know that in Alaska, heavy metals have been passed through breast milk. In fact, there was a point a couple of years ago where the breast milk was toxic with heavy metals in the air. Okay, one more. Really, this is the last one.
I was at the ILADS meeting a couple of weeks ago in Boston. Research says that the organisms can be passed through breast milk as well.
I'm not surprised.
What organisms?
I think the Lyme and co-infections is Dr. Ann Corson. It's really in the herbals as well. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so a break? 15 minutes. Thank you so much for your attention. I know this is difficult, but you've been great.